This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to come and speak. After last year, I was surprised you let me back, but thank you very much. There is nothing new except what has been forgotten, Marie Antoinette. The reason why I've chosen this quote to begin with will become apparent very soon. Firstly, I have to make some acknowledgements. A lot of the data you will see is proprietary data. You can't get unless you're a subscriber or you're going to read my thesis in 3 months' time. And trust me, you won't want to do that. Firstly, I really have to thank Elroy Dimson, Paul Marsh and Mike Saunton, London Business School. Without them, this talk, my thesis, would not be possible. If you have a chance, you should all buy Triumph of the Optimist, their book. It looks at 101 years of global investment returns. It is essential reading. If you think you know anything, read it, and you realise how the world changes. Housing data is from Neil Munnery. Anyone who owns a house is interested in housing. Again, it's on Amazon, Safest Houses. It's probably the best book I've actually read on housing. It looks at the international cost comparisons, and it also, for the very first time, has introduced a 100-year data series. So it's got the UK house prices from 1900. So what I'm going to do tonight is actually talk about bonds, equity, property and bills from 1900. No one has ever done this before. At least, I can't find anyone, and I've been reading a lot. So, with that, moving on. Bubbles and asset prices, that's me. I have actually been working at John D. Wood & Company most of the time. So, so I have been working. I was out on two inspections this morning. So, bubbles. Went up to Cambridge, thought, I've got a theory. Why do bubbles occur? Why have they perpetuated? I can see some friendly faces in the property world, and we've had a jolly good ride, let's say, for the last 15, 20 years. So, why? Well, I did some reading. It's probably a little bit difficult to read up there. I might actually have to put on my glasses. And it all comes down to you, me, human behaviour. The reason why bubbles occur is something called dopamine. I went up to, as I said, to Cambridge, and I thought I was going to be learning about vector autoregression and weird and wonderful things. It's nothing to do with that. It's about dopamine. When you buy things, you release dopamine. It's a natural high. Saving investment doesn't release the dopamine. So when you buy things, you want to buy things, you want to consume. So human beings have an innate predisposition to overconsume. So this is a little chart I did. So you have the innate human behaviour. Consumption releases dopamine. Have growth of money credit in excess of economic growth. That leads to rising asset prices. We then have accelerators. So you've got pro-cyclical behaviour of banks. Prices go up. They lend more, 100% mortgages, 110% mortgages. Financial liberalisation, Big Bang. In actual fact, the Credit Control Act was far more important than 1971. You then have capital inflows. I mean, the world is very international now, so you have a lot of hot money coming in. Kirill, who's here, has written a very nice paper on basically inflows. And if asset prices are going up, as we can see in London at the moment, 95% of properties being bought in Mayfair, Belgravia are actually being bought by foreigners, and that money's coming into the country. And then we have Robert Shiller, human behaviour, herd instinct. My God, everyone's buying. I've got to buy too. You see it in the in the papers. You watch location, location, location. But you watch it, you think, oh, I've got to buy. So everyone goes to a boom. It then goes back, and it basically reinforces itself. We then hit Minsky moment, hit the brick wall. The debt growth is so unsustainable, economic growth can't catch up with it, and the process goes into reverse, and we have asset price depreciation. that's where we are today, if you haven't guessed. So going up there, I thought, okay, I've got a theory. I like the quantity theory of money. And in actual fact, I thought it was Irving Fisher. But in actual fact, first person to come up with it was Nicholas Copernicus in something or the other of 1526. That's all foreign to me. However, to work out excess money in the economic system, because that's how I've decided to actually look at bubbles. Can I actually calculate a bubble? Is there a bubble? How can I calculate it? And I thought, well, excess money. It's a good theory. Use the quantity theory of money. So I've adapted it slightly. I won't bore you. I've assumed money is endogenous rather than exogenous. Long words, which I'm still trying to work out. But basically, it all boils down to, over the long term, monetary growth must be equal to economic growth. That's it. Monetary growth. And thankfully, Mervyn King isn't here, because he will be shot when this comes out. This is the chart. The most important chart, well, actually the second most important chart you'll see tonight. How interesting is that? It's not very interesting. I actually used the data series from the Bank of England. They're incredibly helpful. Ryan Thomas, the Bank of England, knows more about monetary economics than I will in my entire life. Wonderfully helpful. And this is the monetary data, basically from 1870. And what I plotted is the excess money within the economy since 1870, so 140 years. No one else has done it, so I thought, why not? What's really interesting is that if the quantity theory of money is true, and it's been going for 486 years, so, you know, could I prove it? Well, in actual fact, we run something called an augmented Dickey-Fuller test, but it proves it's stationary. There's no trend. So in other words, the quantity theory of money holds true. So that actually is an empirical proof for the quantity theory of money. Last person to do that was Robert Lucas in 1980, and he got a Nobel Prize, but let's move on. I'm not saying anything, really, it's just... Anyway, here we go. What actually happens? Well, that was annual net money there. So I was thinking, as you do, in the middle of Sainsbury's, had my eureka moment. Well, the money doesn't actually leave, does it? It accumulates. So let's just plot it cumulatively. And there we go. That is the most important graph I have ever seen. Not to put too fine a point on it, it is basically excess money in the economy. And according to that, Mervyn King should be stripped of his knighthood. I hope no one is here from the Bank of England. But basically, if there's excess money in the economy, it must go into asset prices. If it's not going into economic growth, it must go into asset prices. What's interesting is that, as you'll see, it went around the red line, and it's mean reverting up until about the 1920s, and then it exploded, and we all know what happened in the 1920s. And then towards the end of the 1920s, we had the stock market crash. In actual fact, we came off the gold standard in 1931. 1932, we brought in the general tariff, but the Bank of England did quantitative easing. Lionel Robbins, writing in 1934, was basically described what the Bank of England is doing now. So in actual fact, what the Bank of England is doing now in quantitative easing is nothing new. They're just following their old textbook. And what they did is buy assets, they tried to pump the money into the economy, and they did. If you actually look at HP figures and various other things, they actually pumped money in. And you actually see rising asset prices. And cars were being bought, etc. So in actual fact, the 1930s, in terms of asset prices, wasn't too bad. We then had the collapse in 1938. In actual fact, everyone remembers Irving Fisher's famous quote, but also John Maynard Keynes in about 1937, 1938 said, the stock market's so low, it can't go any lower, and then proceeded to lose another 70%. So what actually happened during the Second World War was the government printed huge amounts of money. Why? Dropped the cost of war loans. They needed to finance. So what they did, that's the spike, the war loans, the government printing money, and then since about 1946, 1947, it collapsed down. And if you've been holding war loans, government bonds since then, I'm afraid you would have been very severely hurt. We then have the Barber boom. That's a little peak at the bottom. And then we have the rise up to where we are now. According to this chart, it said the status from the Bank of England, there's still, well, at the peak, there's about 40% more monetary or money in the economy than there was in the peak in 1946. So it's quite worrying in that respect. So again, data from the Bank of England, very helpful and incredible of them. I plotted the money multiplier, which basically looks at narrow money versus broad money. Narrow money is the Bank of England printing money. That's your coins. I've got some more money. Ooh, I've got £20. So £20, this is what the Bank of England produces. But the vast amount of money in the economy is actually through fractional reserve banking. If I give £100 to a bank, that's still legally my money. But they will then proceed to actually lend £98 out, which then becomes someone else's money. So it multiplies through the system. So this, again, 140 years worth of data. You look at this and just say, well, hang on a minute, it's just exploded. And we know that at the peak of the boom, Lehman Brothers, people were working off reserves of, you know, 2-3%. So in other words, there was a multiplier of 50 to 33 times. So the fractional reserve banking system has just exploded. And that really started, as you can see, in 1971. And that was the Credit Control Act in 1971 that came in and allowed banks to reduce their reserves assets. In other words, allowed the multiplier to expand and the banks to just basically print money in the nicest possible way. So here we go. That's a bubble. Bank of England could do it. As I said, that's a damning indictment to the Bank of England's policy for the last 30, 40 years. Moving swiftly on. The relative performance of assets. So having done that, I moved on and said, well, I should statistically be able to see something in asset prices. And statistically, yes, I can. This is the real house price graph. So I've allowed for inflation. I've deflated it by CPI. Again, Neil Munnery, Safest Houses, has provided this data. I do urge you all to read his book. It is a very, I mean, you can read it in 2 hours. It's a very quick, easy read. But you can see that house prices literally for the first, well, from 1900 to about 1950, 1960, didn't really do very much. And then slowly built up, 1970, barber boom. And the real explosion came in the 1980s as we had, again, reserves were decreased. And we actually had profusion of personal credit. And then we had that peak, late 80s, collapse. And then we've had this rise and went up fivefold. And in real terms, as you can see, it went over 500, it's down to 400. So it's off by over 20% in real terms. So, very interesting. And it is, you know, incredible, because prior to this, we had to rely on the nationwide data series from 1952. And if anyone's interested in deferment rates, basically, in 1952, basically, you're just capturing the rise. So that's why on deferment rates, which is a discount rate on property, they're arguing for long-term real growth on property of 2%. In actual fact, it should be closer to 0.5% to 0.8%. So this is actual empirical proof that the tribunals and deferment rate is wrong. Moving on, bills. So government bills, you just roll over. Again, from 1900, again, courtesy of Elroy Dimson and Marsh. Elroy Dimson, it's just incredible the amount of work they put in to actually construct this data. So since 1900, in real terms, it's gone up threefold, and it's come off recently in the last couple of years. This is the one that surprised me, equities. Hasn't it been the century of equities? Not according to this. Allow for inflation. 1900, 100, at its peak, December 99, hit 300. Since then, it's down below 200. It's down, in real terms, 33%. Now, this is the real capital growth. You won't actually see this in this book. They very kindly let me borrow this when I asked for it. Because normally they actually issue shares with dividends reinvested. It looks much better. It's an exponential curve. It just goes, whee! Which is great. If you can afford to actually put money into shares and just reinvest the dividends, wonderful. But most people actually need to live off income, dividends, etc. So this was, again, a very exciting graph, or at least I thought. It's quite interesting, as I said, if you actually look at it from 1900, equities up to about 1955, 1960 didn't do very much. And then they took over from bonds, like property. Bonds went, people suddenly realised that bonds weren't such a safe investment, and money transferred from one asset to another. You then had the collapse in the mid-1970s, and then the build back up as the cult for the equities continued. This is bonds. Again, sheer fall in the First World War. Government reflated in 1932, and that's picked up on this chart very nicely. As I said, in 1931, they came off the gold standard and then announced that they were literally going to push money into the economy, and that helped the real return on bonds. That excess money went into bonds. So that went up, and then it hit a new peak in 46 as they pumped more money in, of course, dropped the coupon rate on war loans, and then it fell. I was actually reading a paper the other day of someone who'd been left a very nice inheritance, they'd said, and they're all in war loans in about 1945, 1946. And they said it was, they were young at the time, left by the grandparents, and it would have been enough for them to buy a very large house. By the time they were actually old enough to actually take it out and use it, they couldn't even put it down a deposit. So bonds, again, yes, I think it's 1975 that index-linked bonds came in, but that shows the real effect of inflation. And as we all know, they're going up. Why? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. So, what's better? It depends over what time frame. Looking at this, you would look at it and say, well, in actual fact, at the moment, bonds are better. But if you went back 3 years, property was better. And if you went back even further, you could say bills were better. So, it swings and roundabouts. And it's actually quite interesting. They're all showing that there's a rise in the 1930s, then 1940s, and then drops off and then comes back in the 1970s. So that's asset prices, he says. In deleveraging, there's flight to quality. And this is what we're seeing. As I said, equities hit a peak December 99. Excuse me now, but for those in London, the rest of the country hit a peak in 2008, and bonds are still going up. So what you actually have is there's movement within asset classes. So if you have money, you'll say, okay, I'm selling my property up in the north of the country or the southwest, I'm going to buy into Belgravia. It's a flight to the deepest, most liquid, most prestigious type of asset. And in this country, it's Belgravia, Mayfair, Notting Hill, maybe. So you see a flight to the high quality within an asset class, and you also see a flight to the most deep and the deepest and most liquid market, and that's the bond market. So if you want to know why bonds are going up, it's because people are scared and they're going in to gilts because it's the deepest and most liquid market. So now I've actually used property as an example, because most people here will probably either live in Belgravia, Mayfair, Notting Hill, or Fulham, or the rest of the country. So how different areas compare? Well, we should have all bought in Belgravia, Mayfair. It's new peaks. It's gone up since January 2000, 3.5 times in nominal terms. New peaks. Well done for those who bought in Belgravia, Mayfair. Notting Hill, new peaks. It's gone up threefold. Wonderful. Really great. For those who didn't quite make it, didn't get the bonuses in Fulham, well, you've gone up double. You've doubled. Nationally, you had a peak in 2008, and you're off 10, 12% in nominal terms. So, in actual fact, you look at that and think, there is the flight to quality. That is evidence in the property market. There's the national picture, Fulham, Notting Hill, and the international elite going to Belgravia and Mayfair. But what about inflation? And this is the thing we keep forgetting about. It's monetary illusion, according to Irving Fisher. And a lot of people, we don't think in real terms. As Einstein said, it's all relative, and that's what we need to think about. What's interesting is over the last couple of months, I've actually been asking people what they believe inflation to be. And no one believes the Bank of England and the Office of National Statistics. It's 3-3.5%. Everyone is telling me it's 6-10%. So, but allowing for official inflation, this is what's happened to Belgravia and Mayfair. It's not at new peaks. In actual fact, as you see, it hit 300 and it's below 275. It's about 10-15% off the peak. Notting Hill, still below the peak. Fulham, just hitting a new peak. But nationally, the market is down 25%. So the nationally, the market is falling 6% a year. 4-6% a year, depending on which index you use. So in real terms, again, apologies for those not aware, but in terms of deferment rate, it makes a mockery of the entire argument. So prices are actually falling in real terms nationally, and in the better parts, even Belgravia and Mayfair, prices have gone up because of the international influx, but not as much as we had thought. Here's another interesting one for those who like yields and bonds. You look at the bond market, as I said, it's the deepest, most liquid market, but this is gross yields on property. Again, look at the differential. Differential, Fulham, 3.75%. Notting Hill, just going below 3%. This is gross yield. Belgravia, you're probably at about 2.5%. So it's following the yields of the actual bond market. But the thing is that that's the gross yield. In actual fact, as Sebastian, who's another surveyor here, will tell you, we normally allow 30-35% off to net it down. So that means the actual net yield is down to, 1.5-2%. So it's following a similar pattern to gilts. As I said, people are moving, you're looking at the herd behaviour, which I find very interesting. So if interested in investing, what next? Hyman Minsky did the Minsky moment and wrote his instability hypothesis. He came up with three types of finance: hedge finance, speculative finance, and Ponzi finance. Now, for an asset to be, I would actually call them hedge assets, the return on the asset should actually pay off the interest and the capital repayment. So that's a hedge, what I would term a hedge asset. Speculative asset is one where the asset actually, it will pay off, you said it won't actually pay off very much, but it will pay off the interest and you're looking for capital appreciation. Ponzi finance is where the initial return doesn't even cover the actual cost of finance. You're just looking for capital appreciation. Technically, you look at the yields being offered. These are gross or net yields, allowed for inflation. And where does that come under the definition? So, we have to be very careful. The market is still flooded with liquidity. That's depressing yields and keeping values still high, albeit they're coming down with deleveraging. The excess money is being destroyed as asset prices fall. But what you have to bear in mind is over the 318-year history of the Bank of England, the long-term real base rate is about 3.225%, which if you actually add that onto the current inflation rate, you should be looking at a Bank of England base rate of about 6.5-7%. How many assets could you finance if you had to pay interest of 7.5-8%? Not many. What's interesting is that why do people actually buy gilts or Belgravia or Mayfair if it's just yielding 2.5% or 1% or 1.5%? And I actually read some really interesting comments. It was from Japanese investors. They were asked, why? Why have you bought Japanese bonds? They're negative real yield. And they actually said, capital preservation. I thought, okay. In nominal terms, yes, but in real terms, no. But the second reason was patriotism. They actually believe it. They're in for the national good. So there you have investing, preservation, patriotism, or are you looking for risk? What does this all mean? Since I'm drawing to a close, I think what we're seeing, again, looking at the history books which have talked and looked at long-term credit and economic cycles, you'll see a rise in wealth taxes, as Henry and Paul will tell you at the back, mansion taxes, you know, new level of stamp duty, etc. You're going to see more of those because there's not enough income left to tax. So what will the government do? They have to tax wealth. The easiest wealth you can tax is property. You can't move it. Well, unless you have a caravan. But so rising wealth taxes. We see the rise of political extremism. We've already seen that in Greece, France. Look at the rise of Golden Dawn, National Front, etc. Again, through history, it is common. When you have deleveraging on this scale, the politicians are too afraid to tell the truth to the population. So they congregate in the middle, leaving a vacuum at either end of the spectrum. Unfortunately, that gets filled. What we will also see is volatility in the asset markets as the hot money flows from commodities, from gold to oil, back into German bunds, which are offering negative return at the moment. Why? Because people think Germany will leave and therefore they'll, you know, be revalued and changed into Deutschmark, so you get capital appreciation. It's very interesting. I mean, it's all human behaviour. I thought it was about economics, it's about human behaviour. So you're going to see further volatility in asset markets, further compression of yields. I was writing this, and as most people know, I've actually thought the London market has been overvalued since at least 97. And it's a running joke within the industry. I said it's been overvalued since 97. I've been right. But the thing is that, you know, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, to quote Keynes. So I expect further compression of yields. So that means prices in Belgrave and Mayfair will probably still go up. Probably Notting Hill. Hopefully Fulham. I said hope. So if you see further compression of yields. So I'm expecting, you know, house prices in key areas to go up. You look at the Russians coming in. French, Greeks, Italians. You said the odd Italians here tonight. So I expect, you know, house prices to go up in nominal terms, but in real terms, it's very different. Bank of England loses credibility. And this, I'm afraid to say, is a great danger. Because the more and more people I speak to and ask about what the real level of inflation is, most people do not believe the Bank of England and the government. And we're a credit-based system. Credit is belief. If we lose belief in the monetary currency, that's it. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think the Bank of England, by perpetually missing its targets and not taking any notice of savers and investors and pensioners, but just trying to help out the debtors, they're running a very real risk. But I expect further quantitative easing. Einstein again said, you know, definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Well, madness resides within the Bank of England. So we see more quantitative easing. They don't know what else to do, and they're trying to offset the deleveraging by pumping more money into the system. But it's an uphill battle. So the future, I think this is a lovely quote. George Osborne, well done. It's about the only thing you've done. Worthy. Printing money is the last resort of bankrupt governments. This, as I said, is the most important graph I have come across. Not because I did it, that's the data from the Bank of England, anyone can do it, because it actually explains what, you know, the deleveraging. That is deleveraging. That is the destruction of excess money within the economy. It's mean reverting. And yes, I've got lots of regression series and tables and things I don't know about, which says it's all statistically significant and correlated to property and bonds. Equities is too much of a random walk. You know, it is what it is. It is statistically significant to 0.0001%. But it's mean reverting. It means that in real terms, we're likely to see falling asset prices. So, the conclusion, think in real terms. There's no reason why you should accept it, unless you've got a mortgage and children at school and you can't escape. Yes. So, you have to think in real terms. And I actually had some investors come to see me. They had a central London portfolio, a large portfolio in central London. And 18 months ago, they said, what should we do? And I said, well, sell through John D. Wood & Company, great firm. X, Y, and Z. They came back to see me literally 6 weeks ago. They said, we didn't take your advice. Why am I surprised? But haven't we done well? I said, yes. You know, values, you know, nominal values are up 25%. And I said, well, do you remember what I actually told you to do? And they said, yes. You said, you know, put it into Swiss francs, krona, go abroad. I said, have you looked at the currencies? Yes, well, they're up 30%, 35%. Well, there you go. So you've got to think, you know, internationally, you've got to think in real terms and look to quality assets. You know, it is important, as I said, I do expect prices to go up. I mean, there's certain parts of the country, if you're looking for a country house at the moment, it's going to best bids. You know, I've heard of something that didn't even come to the market, and it went for 10 million over the guide, simply because everyone wanted it, because they see London and this country, the international elite, as a safety deposit box. Their friends are here, they will always be able to sell here, there's no corruption, etc. It's a great place to be. So, yeah, you will probably see, in nominal terms, house prices. You know, you might even see further compression. I expect to see further compression on gilts. But the big mistake we always make, and I've made it a number of times, is we forget the power of the government. And I came across this, and I couldn't believe it when I read it. In 1933, the US government, under Executive Order 63201, confiscated gold. It's amazing. Don't ever underestimate a government. They, you know, they can make laws, and most importantly, as we're finding out through quantitative easing, they control the printing press. That's it. Thank you very much.